Most folks are done. Some folks still finishing up, so I'll give you another 5 minutes on this. Again, if you don't feel compelled to steal all the money, I've only stolen $2,000 from my good friends. I've left their other accounts alone for now. I'll probably circle back when I demo in five. But try to wrap it up in five. We did have two students who needed to power down and give their VM more RAM to get things working. And no one's failed that I see as far as not by many fail. I mean the Android emulator, like, just not working. So we're looking good in the room that way. Get about five more minutes, and I'll recap, and I'll also show the $1 million challenge. Just for the students online, John here let the greed get the better of him and attempted to steal $50 quadrillion, and after successfully doing so, decided he needed more. And I bought everything on planet Earth. I want to buy other planets now, I guess, is the mindset, right? And he stole so much money, he crashed the bank. Which, I want to be clear, I think it's awesome. So how do you set it back to the old days when you were poor with $1,500 in your account? And you don't need to do this, but if you want to reset the bank to where it started, at least the money, I don't know about the accounts, but if you just messed up the money because you've hacked too hard, there's a directory called op android lab bank server, and there's bank.db and bank.db.orig. If you power off or stop the Android script and the bank server script, copy bank.db.orig back to bank.db, you'll reset the accounts. You don't need to do it for the lab, but if you hack so much or you want to redo the lab, clean start, not required at all, but if you'd like to, that's what you do. You copy opt Android Labs lab server. I'll blow up the font a little, you see it a bit better. What do you mean juggle accounts?
So I screwed up like something, so I had like -$99,000 in my credit account.
You're a bad thief, by the way, but go on.
I had like expected amount in my credit account.
I see.
So I went to try and fix it. So you put your debit, your credit account,
yeah,
in the from account.
Yeah.
And then the,
right.
Right,
exactly.
And then
so just a student was telling me that he had negative, you know, almost $1 million in one account and a lot of money in the other, and he restole to get himself back out of overdraft protection because the interest rate on that would be tough to pay. Yeah. All right, so just I was saying, again, not required for the lab, but if you want to reset the bank to the original account balances, opt Android lab server, copy bank.db.orig to bank.db. And I would stop Android and the bank server before you do that. That'll reset the money to where it was, because if you've stolen $50 quadrillion, the feds might come. I don't know. You might want to put it back to where it was. All right, I'm going to go over this. I think everyone's done. A couple of students had some technical issues with their VM as far as RAM and number of cores. We had two or three in the room. I think three in the room in the end had to bump up a RAM core. I've been debating, see, the thing I'm juggling here is one thing we could do, and I have kind of two minds on this. I could just give the VM more RAM out of the gate and more cores out of the gate. And that would work if everyone followed the laptop requirements, and not everyone does. And I want to be I want all the students to be successful. Like, maybe your boss read this for you, or maybe you missed it, whatever. I want everyone to be successful, so we try to limit the overhead of the RAM and the CPUs, because you might have a very simple laptop. So if we bumped up the RAM and the CPU, students that had the wrong laptop would suffer more. Or if we don't, we have this problem with the Android lab. I think in the end, it's all fixable pretty easily. So I think I'll keep it the way it is, but as long as we give the caveats up front. So let me show you this. I'll put the mic on because I'm holding it right now. All right, so Fun Lab, and I have got comments once, and I disagree. But I had a student tell me, and let me know what you think. Of course, I just said I disagree. I kind of poisoned the well, but not on purpose. But I had a student say, hey, you know, that's a mobile lab. It's not a web lab. So why do we have this? It should be in a mobile class. I'm like, it is a web lab. You know, that's, you know, right? I mean, it's a web lab. It's kind of sexy, you know. I'd never run Android in an emulator before until this lab. I think it's kind of cool. You can download these Android emulators for free, by the way. It's all free. The software is free, and you know, I picked an older one only because, again, I wanted less of a memory footprint. If I cranked up like a Dragonfly Android VM, it'd consume 16 gigs of RAM. That's not going to work. So I picked an older one just to, again, keep the CPU requirements low. But you can download your own Android VMs for free and run them just like we are for free. And you can play around. I think it's fun. It's not a world I spend a lot of time in, you know, hacking Android stuff. My friends like Chris Crowley do. But no, a lot of folks are agreeing. I mean, you can see that, and the point I've been making all week long, that your phone is full of web apps, really, is what it is. And Burp works and Zap works. If you took the mobile web app pen testing course, you're going to be using Burp and Zap and hacking away. It's all web stuff, you know? So mobile hacking is web hacking, and it's really the future of web hacking if you think about it. You know, old man Conrad here carries around a laptop with a keyboard, although not on inbound flights from Europe apparently pretty soon, but another story there. Not happy, unimpressed. I think any younger people are much more, of course, on phones and tablets, and I think that will only continue. I don't think the laptop's going away, says old man Conrad, you know, but Steve Jobs made this analogy years ago when he was right. The idea that somehow tablets would make laptops and desktops disappear, his point was, no, we have cars and we have trucks, you know, and we have more cars than trucks, but we still have trucks. You know, just because we have cars, trucks didn't go away. We have all kinds of different trucks, and computers are like that. I think most of humanity will be using a laptop and a cell phone. Most probably already is, right? But for, I mean, programming on a, you know, maybe in the future they'll get much better, but the idea of like coding on some sort of a virtual keyboard, like using VI in a virtual keyboard, or data entry stuff, or it's hard to imagine doing that, old man Conrad says. You know, maybe the interface gets so much better, you know, but it'll work. So I don't think the laptops, desktops are going away, but clearly phones and tablets are becoming an increasing part of our future. You know, Microsoft went from 90% OS share to 20-something percent and dropping fast. Why? Phones, tablets. Android is Linux. Apple iOS is BSD, at least in Newsland, Unix. And the vast majority of the Internet of Things is Linux, you know. And all these things have web apps. So I've already stolen $1,000 from each of my good friends. And I'm going to go, I haven't touched this in a while, so I could be logged out. We'll see. Yeah, it'll do that. And I'll log back in. I'll just steal from one of the debit accounts. I won't try to clean it all out. I'll steal $500 from one of the debit accounts. I'll turn intercept on. And I'll go back here and hit transfer. And I'll change it to, I think if I do this right, we'll see. And then I'll go to the $1 million challenge either way. Then I'll go to transfer. Yeah, that worked. I just stole another $500 from one of my good friend's debit accounts. So I stole $1,000 from each account, and then I throw $500 from the other account. In this case, the we played the +1, -1, +2, -2, which is exactly what I would do. Always try a negative number, which of course will help us in the next part. Always try 0, always try 1. I used to try 0 first. And I also try +1, -1, +2, -2. And a Burp Repeater could automate that. A great question. How do I try 1,000? How do I try 10,000? Burp Repeater can do that. You can also do it in Python. I'm going to show you Python in the upcoming lab. Let's go to the $1 million challenge. So I'm going to enter, turn intercept back on. Enter 1, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Did I do that right? Yeah. And I'll hit transfer. Boom. And now we're going to make it negative. And we're going to make the, which way are we going here? I'm getting confused now. The from account. Change the to account, right. So, right? Change it, yeah, okay. I got confused myself, even though I wrote this part. So, I'm transferring negative $1 million to one of my good friends. A lot of people are confused here, but it's basic, you know, high school or not even high school math. You know, one plus three is four. 1 + -3 = -2. You know, you, if you're adding a negative, you're subtracting. That's as simple as that. So if I'm adding a negative to my good friend, I'm subtracting. If I made this a million, I give him a million. If I made it a negative million, it's going the other way. So let's see if I did that right. And accounts. Did I do it right? Yep, they did it right. Yeah, I noticed that, Andy. In my testing, I think I thought that was important, but I didn't touch it there. I think it works either way, so yeah, that's correct. Trailing zero should work. I think it might have been a different proxy, maybe. I know in some of my testing, the trailing zero caused a problem. I don't think it caused a problem if you follow the lab exactly, but when I built the lab, I was testing various things, and I think that was a caveat in case you went in a different way, but that's correct, Andy. And you notice on the refresh, it's still deal value, but then I hit it again, and there it is now. I have $1 million. And the record in the room is apparently $50 quadrillion. So John's bought Planet Earth and all things on it. And I love that. That's awesome. That is the hacking mindset, my friend. I like that. Steal all the money. So the bank is now bankrupt. Your friend's now bankrupt. But all right, questions on that? Awesome, awesome. If you had any kind of Android difficulties and you had to bump up your RAM, do feel free to circle back. And again, you know now how to restore the balances if you hack too hard. But I know I'm biased, but I like that lab. And again, I hadn't touched Android as far as that goes until this lab. And I was pretty thrilled. Again, just I downloaded the Android VM myself and installed the app. And it's funny, whenever I see the in the Android emulator where the battery's dead, I feel that Pavlovian need to plug it in, even though it's just an emulator. I do, though. All right. My battery's dying. No. No, it's not. Okay. Python. Named after Monty Python's Flying Circus, so how can I not love this language, right? And Douglas Adams, Monty Python, you're speaking my language, my friends. So it's a very well-designed language, and it was born at a time, you know, I love Perl. I've been doing Perl since 91, but Perl's become a bit of a jumbled up mess. It has, and it pains me to say that, but it's a series of tack-ons and tack-ons and tack-ons and tack-ons. And I love Perl. I can write Perl as fast as I can type almost. I'm a bit rusty now because I do everything in Python now, or most things in Python. I still think if you're carving up text, regular expression support in Perl is the best on the planet. If you're carving up lots of text, I think Perl is the best answer. If you're using sockets, Python is the best answer, in my opinion. The socket handling in Python is very natural. The request library is a dream of ease of use. You can get so much done so quickly. And ultimately, that's when, not to get into a language war, but for me, which language lets me do the most stuff the fastest? That's a good language, you know? And if I'm carving up text, I find the regular expression support in Perl to be superior and natural. Regular expression support, meaning pattern matching, right? And Python's good, but it's not great. It's good. But again, if you're creating sockets, any kind of network traffic, you want to create packets, SCAPI, you want to create web requests, request library, it's well designed and it's well thought out, and the whole pen testing world, most of it has moved towards Python. And again, not to get into a language war, once you learn one, I do recommend at some point learning another. And it's just, you know, it's not like you hire a carpenter who will only use screwdrivers, like a screwdriver for every job. No, the carpenter is going to choose the best tool for the job, and whether it's a screwdriver or a hammer or a saw, whatever. And we should be the same way. We should just, don't get, you know, when I was a young Unix nerdling back in the days, I was like, oh, Microsoft, how lame. And I was just young and dumb, and, you know, I did stuff like that. And I mean, Microsoft was kind of lame then, but to be fair, but DOS wasn't, compared to Unix, DOS was a joke. So I'm reverting to form now, aren't I? Correct that, it is lame, no. And I'm like, whatever, you know, and then I'm a Unix guy, and then I'm like, well, I should learn this stuff because I'm defending this stuff, you know, I'm protecting it, so I should understand it. And so I've learned just the right tool for the job. And basic Python scripts, I created the whole Python directory on your desktop. I populated with a whole bunch of scripts. You know, virtually every example that I mentioned on the slides, there's a script for that in that directory. How to pull down the server header, various things you want, how to do a get, how to do a post. If you look in the Python desktop directory, I created a bunch of these little kind of stub functions. And what I do is I have a basic script that pulls on a web page and does one thing. And then when I want to do something else, I just copy that and just amend it, add to it, change it. You know, so I'll use the base scripts as a building block. And then I'll start adding stuff to it. I'll make a copy. That's how I work. And you had the whole Python directory when I built this lab over Christmas. Spent my Christmas vacation doing a bunch of things, including for this class, including this. It's natively available pretty much everywhere. Well, not natively on Windows, but you can install it on Windows. But on virtually everything else that's recent, Python's there. So any reasonably recent Linux or Unix or anything will have Python. You can install it on Windows, no problem. And it's available on all kinds of even very obscure operating systems like the DOS I mentioned. And it's available on obscure, old, legacy stuff. It is an exhaustive list of ports. You can run it on almost anything. The big debate, Python 2 versus Python 3. Many of us have gotten into the habit of writing Python 2 code. Our class uses Python 3. It's a pretty simple difference. You know, the biggest difference that'll hit you, has hit me, the print statement is now a print function. Print statement in Python 2 is now a print function in Python 3, meaning it's the same command, but you have to put parentheses around the whatever you're printing. It's a minor, minor distinction. Python 3 is the future. If you're starting fresh, you can use Python 3. However, there is a caveat. Most systems still use Python 2 as the native interpreter of Python. When you type Python, you get Python 2. Python 3 is frequently there, but it's called Python 3. And what I've noticed, and this is true for Ubuntu Linux, if you use Python 2, tons of libraries are there by default. It just works. If you use Python 3, many of those libraries are not there. Like the request library is there for Python 2. It's not there for Python 3. And you can install it, apt get requests 3, whatever. But if you want to just get stuff done, you know, TM, you know, Python 2 is there. It's pre-configured. It's ready to go. And all the library, most of the libraries are there. You can add more. Python 3 is also there in a modern Linux, but a lot of the libraries are missing. This will change over time. So I don't spend too much time splitting hairs or being some sort of a purist on. And I find myself writing Python 2 code simply because the system set up for it. Kali is set up with Python 2. Kali has all the libraries for Python 2. And again, you want to use requests on Python. Python 3 is there, call it Python 3. Python 2 just called Python. You know, so you have Python, which is Python 2. Python 3, which is, you know. And then request is installed for Python, meaning Python on Kali now, not for Python 3. And then you can install them. But I find if I just grab Kali and go, Python 2 will move in faster. If I was going to write an open source project, I'd use Python 3. Ultimately, it's not that big a deal. People love to get in flame wars, especially on Python's forced indentation. Man, some old school dudes, you know, programmers, people who don't like using nice formatted code, bristle against this, you know? And Python enforces some rigor, but I don't get involved in these flame wars. Again, I wrote all the code for the class in Python 3, or most, I have some examples in 2, but the labs use Python 3. Your VM is now tuned for these labs. I've added these libraries to your VM that weren't there before. But if you're just using Kali, you want to write a quick script, quick and dirty, sure, Python 2 is fine. And again, here are some issues to consider when people get into these arguments. Why aren't you using Python 3? Well, Kali and Ubuntu Linux 1604 are optimized for 2 still. 3 is there, but they're optimized for 2. Not a big deal. But the distinctions are pretty minor, really, between the two. Print is the one big one. So why write scripts? And this comes down to my mindset on you should program. Many times in class, and many of the bonus scripts, in fact, all of the bonus scripts, there's a bonus appendix at the end of today. If you're jazzed up about Python, you want to learn more Python, if you have extra time during today, go to the end of the book, and there's an extra section on a bunch of bonus Python stuff. Because I would get questions from students like this. Hey, Eric, you talked about how brute forcing, what we call brute forcing in here is really a dictionary attack. And remember when we did cust42.sec542.com? And we found that through a list of words. How do I write a true, what tool, how do I get burp or zap to conduct a true brute force? Meaning like directory AAA, AAB, AAC, ..ZZZ. And I would say, write a script. You know, blank stare. No, but how do I get burp to, it's faster to write a script. Well, show me how to get burp. I'm like, I would have to fumble around with it, and I can write the script faster. So you write a script. And some students just don't even acknowledge that answer because they don't know how to program. And they think that sounds difficult. And it is, of course. If you've never programmed before, that is intimidating. I get it. But I thought, okay, to be fair, I'll write the script, right? And I actually wrote, the old Python lab was a different, you know, we replaced it entirely. And during the old Python lab, you've seen the brand new one, I wrote that script, and it's like, you'll see it. It's like 7 lines of code. And I put it on the screen. I said, type it right there. And I could type, I could create the script faster in Python than I could and create that functionality in Burp. It was fast for me to write. And I used Python before, but the problem with only sticking with the tool, and I love Burp, and I love Zap, is, as I said previously, you're limited by the creativity and the ability of the programmer who created that tool, and also the scope of the features of that tool. You're actually living in a jail created by that tool's creator. You are living in their world. You are limited to their vision and their functionality that they've chosen to add. And again, I love Burp. I'm not knocking Burp, but as soon as you start using Burp, you're limited to what Burp can do. Python can do anything, virtually anything on a network. Burp can't. Burp can do a subset of things that are really cool, useful. And also, Burp and Zap have an overhead. If you did create the directory brute forcer in Burp or Zap, I promise you the Python script would run much, much faster because it's less overhead, you know? So a lot of people don't realize that when you become a bit of a one-trick pony with the tool, they don't realize, again, that they're living in a jail. They've chosen to live in a world of some limitation in some manner. And you unlock that limitation when you write a script. And so when I kept getting, like, for instance, Snake. Hey, Eric, we all saw Snake on day one. This is in the bonus lab. Eric, you said, you know, no matter what the high score is, as long as it's higher than the current high score, I get plus one. So my high score is currently 2502. I want to make it 10,000. How do I do that? I said, well, you have to submit another 7,500 odd high scores. And the beauty of Snake, by the way, if you set the high score to 10,000 and you submit it, and it was, the old high score was 2501, now it's 2502. But you can keep resubmitting that 10,000, 2503, 2504, and the bonus section has this, and then 10,000. So you can keep resubmitting the same exact content 7,500 odd times in a row, high score 10,000. And, well, how do I do that in Burp or Zap? I'm like, it'd be so much easier to write a script. And again, I'll write the script. So these are scripts I've basically written on the fly in class, after class, in the mornings. And they're all great questions. And I realize it's better to tell someone to write a script. I still think it's good advice. But if they don't have the programming background, it's better to also say, and here's a script. And start showing people how unlimited this can be. So here's some examples. How do I take a dictionary and launch a John the Ripper-style hybrid password guessing attack against a website using basic authentication? Meaning take a list of words like octopus and camel and kangaroo and go kangaroo 1, kangaroo 2, kangaroo 3, kangaroo 4. How do I do that? And I just write a script. I wrote the script. Okay? You have that script today in the Python directory. What tool can beat Snake? Write a script. What tool can launch a true directory brute force guessing names of a certain length? And again, many tools can do some of these things, but only one tool or one approach can do all of these things, and that's programming, right? Write your own. So Python is a great answer. I can't talk about Python without talking about Mark Baggett. We all love Mark. He's one of these, I'm very blessed to work with people like Mark and Sam. You know, Sam's is some of the brightest minds in the industry. You know, set me aside from the discussion. Talking about my peers. Some amazing talent. He wrote the Python for Pentesters class. Lots of great resources out there for learning Python. I use Codecademy's Python class. It's Codecademy. I'm always urged to say Codecademy. It's Codecademy. They have a Python class that's free. I took it because the problem I was having with Python is I jumped into the deep end of the pool. I'm a Perl guy. I know C. I know this. And I started doing some very, very advanced Python stuff just out of the gate. And it was working, but I kept stumbling over fundamentals because I hadn't actually learned the fundamentals. And I just kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool and started doing some advanced stuff. But I wanted to shore up some basic, I just was missing some fundamental stuff down to how dictionaries worked and things like that. I just kind of rushed ahead. And I thought, I need to just circle back and cover all the ground and take some kind of a Python class or book or something. And I know that 80% of it I might know, but 20% of it I don't know. And I'm just going to go through the whole thing. Go through the whole thing, and that way I have my foundation built properly, then I can get back to the advanced stuff. So I can personally attest to Codecademy. I took that beginning to end, and I may still be logged into the site. We'll see. I'll pull them up. It's free. They do have a commercial, you know, upgrade version they kind of nag you for, but at least when I did it, they'll say, hey, upgrade to our experience, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So here's a Python class. If I can remember my, my password vault. And yeah, I took it, just in full disclosure, I took it. And I was impressed. And it was free. They will nag you to upgrade to pro. Hey, you should upgrade to pro, you're awesome, be a pro. And I'm like, whatever, you know. I didn't, you know. So if you don't mind that, I took it, I finished it, and then I felt much more comfortable because I had the fundamentals shored up. So highly recommended, free. Lots of good resources here. Mark Baggett's 573. If I were to take a SANS class as a SANS instructor, I don't often get to do that anymore. That'd be on my list. He has a thing called PyWars, daily Python challenges, cool stuff. Let's talk some basic stuff now. It's a pretty logical language. We're gonna basically hit the high notes, hit the things you're most likely to use as a pen tester. I'm not gonna attempt to teach you Python A to Z in the 25 minutes we have of lecture here, or half an hour. I'm gonna hit the high notes, the things as a pen tester you're likely to need. I'm gonna give you a bunch of scripts to do all this stuff, and then we're gonna start with a pretty simple use case and lead you through writing a script, okay? So it's definitely hit the ground running kind of a thing. And we've got strings, booleans, integers, floats. There are some other things. Again, I'm not trying to be exhaustive here. I'm trying to cover the high notes. It's got if, elif, which stands for else if, short for else if, else syntax. And here's a script with a bunch of ifs and else ifs. The indentation is required and must be consistent. A lot of programmers bristle at this formality that's forced on you. You could write a Perl script that's, 10,000 characters as one giant line with no line feeds. You could do that in carriage returns. You could write a C program that way. And some programmers do this because they're mentally ill. They do this because, they've lost their minds and they think this is a good idea. And, I was like, but I do it that way, Eric. You just call me mental. Sorry. I get a little goofy late in the week. I'm sorry. That came out. Sometimes I hear words leaving my mouth. I'm like, yeah. But anyways, the problem with that is, what if someone else has to support that code? It's not always you. You'd be surprised. Now, I was told fairly recently that I wrote some code at Boston University in 1994 that's still running today. And I shudder to think what that code looks like. Like, well, I replaced like 90% of it, Eric, but about 10% of that code is still you. I'm like, wow, that's... So 94, 2017, I'm old, right? I'm officially old. So yeah, if you want to write 10,000 bytes of code without a single line feed or carriage return, Perl will let you do that happily. Be your own bad self. C, sure, go for it. Python, no. Required indentation, meaning whatever level of, whether you use tabs or spaces, and believe it or not, there is, if you Google online, there have been many, many flame wars over the tab versus space debate, believe it or not. Apparently Silicon Valley, I've not seen this episode, has an episode where that comes up. They get into a loud, heated argument on tabs versus spaces. You can use either, and I'm not gonna get into a flame war on this, but it turns out spaces are more portable universally across more systems than tabs. Some systems treat tabs differently. A space is a space is a space. So whether you use two spaces or four spaces, you have to be consistent. Meaning, these print statements all have to be the same level of indentation. If you kick one in four spaces or back it up two, it's gonna throw an error. So they're forcing you to write code that is better formed than Perl or C can be. I don't mind this at all. I came out of the Perl C days. I was always pretty careful about indenting. I wasn't like super crazy about it, but I have no problem being forced to do this. Other programmers disagree. And I happen to use two spaces in our examples only because it helps save real estate on the slide. Four is a very common level. But I'm using two just because I don't want to back too much. The font will start shrinking as I go more to the right, So I'm using two. Two works fine. Four works fine. And we could have some nested loops now, Python loops. Basic building block. And I'm importing from string import ASCII underscore lowercase. A term you'll learn if you start learning Perl is the, quote, Pythonic way. The Pythonic way is the right way to do it. Now, a famous Perl saying is by Larry Wall, there's more than one way to do it, right? Perl says there's more than one way to do it. Being Pythonic is using the right way. So there's a difference in, but in the end, there's lots of ways to do it in Python too. So how do I get a string of A, B, C, D, E, F, G? I can define string equals, quote, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, unquote. Or I can import the string that's already there. So from string, import ASCII underscore lowercase. So ASCII underscore lowercase is now set to this, okay? And then I say for A in ASCII underscore lowercase, I'm gonna loop from A to Z now. For B in ASCII lowercase, what this will do is print AA, AB, AC, AD, dot, 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 ZZ, okay? It'll go through. And it's a building block for the directory brute forcer you're about to write. There's also lists and dictionaries. And a list is just an ordered list of data. Usernames equals ADEN, F prefect, Z Beeblebrox, T McMillan, Trisha McMillan. And for name and usernames, print the name. That will loop and print ADEN, then print F prefect, etc. Dictionaries are similar to lists, but they also set a value. So in a list, it's just a list of values. In a dictionary, they're pairs. So ADEN is set to planet Earth, T McMillan is set to planet Earth, F prefect is set to Betelgeuse 5. So a list is just setting a list of variables. A dictionary, sometimes called a hash, what Perl would call a hash, is a name value pairs, okay? So ADEN set to Earth, T McMillan set to Earth, et cetera. And very importantly for us, beyond the fundamentals, are which libraries to use. And despite the Pythonic claim of there's one way to do it, there should be ideally one best way. We have a ration of web libraries that have evolved over the years. We have HTTP-Lib 1, 2, and 3, URL-Lib 1, 2, and 3, and they all offer an overlapping yet differing amount of support for various things. There's all kinds of overlap, and those are a bit messy. And Request came out, and Request is clearly superior to them. Now, Request has made things much easier to perform, much faster to perform. If you want to do nitty-gritty down, I think one example I was working on, I wanted to force the SSL cipher to be a certain cipher. I wanted to force, like, SSL2 and not let Request negotiate whatever it's going to negotiate for SSL TLS. I wanted to force 2. I couldn't find a way for Request to do it. It was too, like, nitty-gritty, down and dirty. You can still import as many libraries as you want. So I think I imported, like, URL-lib3 as well as Requests, and I used URL-lib3 for that one thing I needed of forcing the SSL version, right? For 98% of my scripting, Request does it. Once in a while, when I want something really down and dirty that I can't get Request to support because they've kind of abstracted it a bit too far away in the name of ease of use, just import the library that does and use that one thing. So it's not an either or at all. Ideally, you'd use one, Request, and that's 98% of the time what I do. Once in a while, I want something more, specific. And again, it's not uncommon for an advanced thing to pull in multiple. So Request is built on top of URL-lib3 and simplifies and abstracts what URL-lib3 does. But there's some URL-lib3 functionality that Request does not have. But you can still use that. You can use both, right? For most of it, you just use Request. Request is a dream. So here's the script to download a page and print it. Not counting the invocation of Python 3, it is 3 lines. In any other thing I talked about, including HTTP-lib123, URL-lib123, you're talking at least 5 lines. Now we're talking 3 lines. Really, the functionality itself is the bottom 2 lines. You import, you kick off Python 3, that's that first line. You import the Request library, and now that you have the Request library, you now have all that functionality. Python has core libraries that are always there, things like print functions or whatever, and other things you import. R is now this object that is going to get that page, and now this object called R has the page in it. It's a variable. And then print r.text, prints the text. There's headers you can print, right? Very, very simple. And to show you how amazing it is, the bottom script does the exact same thing, but also authenticates via basic authentication, still in the same 3 lines. The other libraries, you're probably going past 10 lines now, right? To add the basic authentication. Now with Request, very, very simple. R equals Request get, same page. Auth equals Marvin, comma, paranoid. And this will work on the very VM you're looking at right now. And this script exists, as all the other ones do, right in the Python directory on your desktop. Yes?
So that's with the basic authentication, but what if there is like a certificate involved?
Hold that thought, certificate, like your SSL certificate, you mean? Hold that thought, you're about one slide ahead, but you're right. So the question is SSL certificates, great question. So great, I wrote a slide for it just now. No, I I already have a slide, a couple of slides, but it handles SSL seamlessly, very easily, seamlessly. Great question. More requests, it can authenticate a number of ways. And so basic digest, Kerberos, NTLM, et cetera. And other useful features, we can print the response code, 200 versus say 404 or something. We can print all the headers. We can print the round trip time. Remember the timing attack we launched on, I believe, day two, the advanced username harvesting attack, right? And where we configured Zap to see how long the hash was taking to come back or be encrypted and bcrypt. We could tell based on the bcrypt function being called which accounts were valid. Question on that, it's like, and they said, well, Eric, if I'm running this locally and once in a while an odd wrong result pops in because my CPU slowed down then, or I'm doing it over the internet and the latency introduces some noise, some distractors, what do I do? I said, well, rerun it a few times and you'll always have the same 5, 6, or 7 accounts and the outliers might roll in and out, but they'll always be different. And then, well, how do I make Zap, you know, rerun this? I don't even say write a script, it's just easy. And well, I'll write the script. All these scripts for the bonus stuff, that's a bonus lab, I think, are born out of that. So also time it. How long did it take to come back leads to great timing attacks. You can also perform posts. So we set up a dictionary, variable one value one, variable two value two. So now we can do a post, form auth login.php. So yes, we can even post to a form. So we're posting to a form, the user is Ford, the password is Galaxy, the button is login. So you've used this form on day two. And you manually entered Ford Galaxy, the login button was already there on the page. And when you watch that roll by in Burp or Zap or whatever, you saw these variables going by. Now I can automatically submit them once again, three lines. So now I'm authenticating to a web server, a form in three lines. And to the excellent question on SSL TLS, it handles it seamlessly, invisibly. Now the only issue is by default, it will do a verify equals true, meaning if it's a self-signed cert, Python by default request will not connect to it unless you said verify to false. Now we have two certs in your VM. We have www.sec542.org, which is actually a real cert I bought off Komodo. That's a valid cert. And we have heart.bleed, which is not a valid cert, clearly because it's a made-up top-level domain. I can't buy a cert for a made-up top-level domain. So if you leave it without any setting, meaning there's nothing listed here under verify, it would connect to www.sec542.org and fail against heartbleed. And when it fails against heartbleed, it gives a big, nasty, non-Pythonic error when it does so. If you set verify to false, it'll accept a self-signed or a bogus cert of some sort. So let's put a lot of it together. And Python version of the timing advanced username harvesting attack from 542.2. So you remember that lab, right? When we created a file called combined, right? And then that was 103 lines. And then we configured Zap to attempt to authenticate to all 103 names. Actually, 103 times 26, sorry, right? 103 times 26. So we tried 103 last names, 26 first initials for each, so 26 times 103 attempts, right? And so we're doing the same exact, and then we timed it. Same exact thing here. We import ask, we import requests. We import ASCII underscore lowercase. We read the file called combined into a variable called lines. Lines now has those 103 last names. ASCII underscore lowercase now has A through Z. And we say for init, in ASCII.lowercase, username equals init plus lname. So for lname in lines, so I'll back up one, I jump one into the loop. We have this list of 103 last names in a file called lines. We say for each last name in lines, and then a second loop for each init in ASCII.lowercase, attempt to post. Username, whatever the username is, password, bad pass, right? Against the secure login page. What this will do is loop through all the last names. Let's say it's Smith. And then it'll go A Smith, B Smith, C Smith, D Smith, E Smith, F Smith, etc. And then A Jones, B Jones, dot, dot, Z Jones, and A Den, B Den, C Den, dot, dot, dot. It's a double loop. It's a nested loop. Loop through all the last names, loop through all the initials. The username is initial, join a last name, meaning, you know, A Smith, B Smith, C Smith. Make the request with a bad password. Calculate the round trip time. Print it. And what you can do with that script is run it and then pipe to sort. Sort dash N for the number. It'll sort by the number. And you'll see it'll run faster than Zap did. Blam. And you can literally up arrow run, up arrow run, up arrow run. And you'll time it. So it's the exact same functionality we saw with Zap in Python form. And the heart of the matter, I mean, we had to set up a couple of things. But once we set up a couple of things, the heart of the matter is this loop. And this loop is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines long, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines total. And the main loop is 6 lines, double loop. Loop to all the last names, loop to all the first initials, go, right? Very, very powerful. Print out the round trip time. This is the script when we first launched the password guessing, timing attack on my client. That lab was born out of a client, you know, ripped from the headlines. This is the script I wrote, largely the script I wrote. I cleaned it up for your purposes. But this is essentially what I wrote. Bang. And it worked beautifully. And I know that was a definite crash course in Python. My goal was to not spend a day or more learning Python. We have 573 for that. My goal was to spool you up as quickly as possible and have you start using some of this stuff. So before we hit the, what looks like we'll combine lunch and lab, any questions on that before we do this hands-on? All right, let's do it hands-on. Again, we have bonus stuff at the end of the day. If you go to the day five, appendix, you'll see more. Improve your penetration testing skills, write a simple but a powerful Python script that uses a request library. There are two challenges and there's multiple walkthroughs now. Write a Python 3 script to print the server product string only from a list of web servers contained in a text file. Now, when I built the lecture leading up to this, I dropped enough breadcrumbs, so everything I'm asking you to do, we just discussed. So everything I asked you to, like, we just saw how to read a list of names from a file and loop through them. We just saw that. And I'm asking you to do that again. I'm asking you to create a text file and put two lines in it and then iterate through them. I just showed you how to do that, right? I just showed you on the last slide how to do that. Do not verify the X509 certs, otherwise heart.bleed will blow up. I showed you how to do that. Print the URL file by the server product string. I gave you an example of the server product string. So connect to the sites, put on the server product string, and don't verify the cert. Okay? Second challenge is two challenges. Next slide. There was a three-letter directory, I've hidden on www.sec542.org, and no tools we have used so far have discovered it. Nothing. Zap has not found it. Burp has not found it. Zap's forced browse has not found it. None of the spiders have found it. Now, LS will show it on the local disk, but nothing short of LS on the local disk has found this thing. This thing is well hidden. I'm going to ask you to brute force AAA through ZZZ. I even have some discussion that's going to make 17,000 odd requests. It should run in 10, 12, 20 seconds or so. And common question here is, what if I do 4 letters? What if I do 5 letters? What if I do 6? Sure, I've done 6. It takes a lot longer. So let's say it takes 20 seconds to run it once. If you, 3 letters. If you go to 4 letters times 26, right? You go to 5 letters times 26 times 26, you know, you get the idea of the math. I've done 6 letters over the internet. It took, you know, a week or so. We did it. And we found all kinds of interesting stuff, right? Well, I guess enough interesting stuff to make it very worthwhile. I guess a better way of putting that, right? So brute force challenge again. This lab specifically was born out of an awesome student question of the brute forces you're showing us are actually dictionary attacks. How do I do a real one? I'm like, what? That's a great question. It is. It's a great question. And so I like when, since Seth and I have been involved and we've rewritten about 85% of the class, I do like that feedback loop of students having great questions and me seeding future content that way. It makes for me feel the class kind of lock in. You know, that's what I know I'm biased, but we do a lot of that. And we do a lot more updates. We didn't need to update 85% of this class. We could have updated 30% of the class, but I want it to be, you know, I take pride in this kind of stuff, you know, and I work hard at it. And I feel, as you can probably glean, I feel passionate about programming. I think more people should do it. I think more people would benefit. So I love this kind of stuff. So there are three levels of hints. There is the upfront challenge just issued, okay? Remember, there's two parts. There are the some hints for levels challenges one and two, and then full walkthrough, okay? Three levels of hints. Some students get stuck on a previous level of hint. If you've never programmed before, there was absolutely no shame whatsoever in taking some hints and moving ahead. It's funny, Cyber Defense Net Wars last night, I went to the feedback, and one student's, I didn't explain it well enough. They didn't like the hints because they were being abused. I'm like, how do you abuse a hint? You know, what does that mean, you know? And I'm like, I'm trying to understand. I need to talk to that student more, but the whole point of a hint is it's there if you need it, you know? And anyways, take the hints. I don't know, some people think it's somehow cheating. I don't know. It's there for you, of course. So three levels of hints. One level is just do it. Second level is some hints. Third level is walkthrough. The answers are also in the Python directory as well. So work on that. I have 1152. We'll call it 1:35, so a half an hour for the lab and plus lunch, okay? And remember, there will be some folks in here during lunch for my lunchtime talk of how to be a SANS instructor. For the folks online, that is going to be recorded, by the way. I don't know when it's going to show up online, but if you're curious about that, it is going to be recorded. And it just describes my journey beginning as a student who'd never taught at all to mentor to ultimately I'm a senior instructor and co-curriculum lead now and multi-course author. And I'm passionate about that story because I walked in off the street. I didn't know anyone. I wasn't anyone's friend. I wasn't anyone's cousin or brother or whatever. I wasn't well known in the industry, and I just worked hard, you know. And whether you want to be an instructor or you want to work with SANS more formally, SANS has all kinds of stuff. They have people who write GIAC questions. They have people who test labs. A lot of that stuff is actually, it works well with a day job because it's kind of like, you know, get this done by 6 weeks from now. However you get there is up to you. So it's also just getting more involved with SANS if you want to. You know, it doesn't have to be a teacher or instructor.
What time is that coming out?
It's going to be at 12:30 today during lunch, yep. If you haven't signed up, it's officially full, but my rule is you're all VIPs, and I'm not throwing you out of the room because you're a VIP. So it's technically sold out, but if you want to hang out, just hang out. And if anyone gives you a hard time, send them to me.